You're listening to a Davenport After Dark podcast. Tune in every Thursday night at 10 o'clock on News Talk 106 to 108. Earlier today, Ariel Castro was arraigned on charges of kidnapping and rape after three women missing for nearly a decade were found in his home. And while the terrible ordeal of Amanda Berry, Gina De Jesus and Michelle Knight may be at an end, their immediate futures are bound to be challenging as they begin the process of adapting to normal life after so many years in captivity. There are challenges that have been faced by other long-term kidnapped victims like JC Dugard, who was missing for 18 years, Natasha Campush, who spent 8 years in a basement in a quiet Vienna suburb, and Elizabeth Fritzl, who was imprisoned for 24 years by her own father, Joseph, before being released in 2008. During her captivity, she was raped repeatedly and gave birth to seven children, three of whom were taken upstairs to be raised by Joseph and his unsuspecting wife, Rosemary. Tony Patterson is the Berlin correspondent of the English Independent and has followed the story of the Fritzls since the very beginning. Good evening to you, Tony.
Good evening.
5 years now since Elizabeth's release. Where is she now?
I know where she is. She lives in a village not very far away from the town where this horrible crime was committed. She's been given a new identity. She lives surrounded by neighbours who are very much aware of her predicament, and they have formed a sort of dad's army, if you like, and they alert people if anybody appears, like photographers or journalists, and immediately ring up the police. The police are not very far away. Security guards living round the family, at least that was the state of play when she moved in there. I don't know whether it's relaxed a bit now. And she's just been shielded completely from the public. Nobody's heard anything from her.
And these extraordinary measures taken to protect her identity, are they for life or for as long as Elizabeth so wants them?
I'm pretty sure that it's for as long as she wants them. I think the initial reason for imposing these draconian measures was the fact that right from the beginning, the press sort of surrounded the hospital where she and her children were being kept. And then one has to remember that Austrian laws are very, very strict regarding the sort of personality rights and protecting people from the media. And the fact, of course, this is the most important factor, that she's got young children, and the feeling was that they should not be molested by the press. So that's the state of affairs.
And is that press hunger still there? If they knew where she was, would they camp out like they did outside that treatment centre?
I don't think the Austrian media would get involved. I think the greater interest is in the sort of international media, particularly, I have to say, the British tabloid press, because they were the sort of worst offenders, if you like, at the time.
She was diagnosed with PTSD, which isn't surprising, but it's a little bit unsatisfactory. It seems like a bit of a catch-all term. How did she go about even beginning to address the profound nature of the trauma that she suffered?
There's a press blackout on everything that she's done. What we do know is that she had the security guard who was billeted in this village where she lives, and she's supposed to have started a relationship with him and improved an awful lot since that relationship. But this is some years ago now. This is about 2 or 3 years ago that we've heard of the relationship. She's done things like she's taken a driving test. She was supposed to have bought a car, drives around the area, all under a new identity. The children are apparently going to school and doing quite well. She has also managed to establish a proper relationship with her mother, Rosemary, who lived upstairs and looked after her three brothers and sisters, and apparently that's okay, that's going all right. She's re-established that relationship, so it does suggest that there's a certain degree of normality that has returned to her life. I mean, to what extent she's overcome the trauma, it's impossible to say. I don't think anybody overcomes that kind of trauma, to be frank.
And how long did it take to rebuild that relationship with her mother? Because her mother lived in the house with her father above the basement where she was locked up.
That's right. And she looked after three of the children that she had with Fritzl from the incestuous relationship. Fritzl took these three children away and gave them to his wife, saying that Elizabeth Fritzl had had these children. She belonged to a religious sect and couldn't be bothered to look after them, and therefore would you look after them? How she re-established the relationship? Well, when the whole thing came to light in 2008, the two of the six brothers and sisters were brought together. Elizabeth was with the three downstairs children, or underground children, in the mental hospital. The other three children came to visit them, and so did the mother. And through that, a relationship was re-established. It took some time, but apparently now they're getting on relatively well.
The case is extraordinary for a bunch of reasons, but also as well for the fact that there were, well, originally seven children, of which only six survived, but as you said, three of whom were raised above stairs and three of whom had to continue living in this dungeon. Do we know anything about the relationship between the siblings themselves?
Not really. They don't let much out. I mean, we know certainly that the upstairs children have rebonded, if you like, with the downstairs children, and this was an essential part of their rehabilitation, if you can. The psychiatrists encouraged that. They encouraged them to visit. They lived in this sort of open type of wing of the mental hospital. All the doors had to be kept open the whole time because anything being shut reminded them of being in the cellar. A radio was kept on because that gave them the feeling that they were in contact with the outside world. And the youngest child, Felix, spent quite a lot of his time just going outside and stroking the grass and looking at the clouds because he'd never seen anything like that before. But part of this, of course, part of the therapy was to make sure that the mother, Elizabeth Fritzl's mother, and her other children, the three upstairs children, regularly visited them in the psychiatric unit, and a relationship was properly re-established.
Do we know if Elizabeth has found employment? Is she working? Do we know how she kind of occupies her day?
Well, the last thing I heard was that she was she'd taken a driving test and had got that together and was thinking of buying a car. But that's, at this point, the news blackouts come in, and the Austrian media hasn't published anything at all about her since then. All we've heard is that Fritzl, from prison, has divorced his wife, and that his wife has swung the other way and made the contact with the children. But we don't know anything more. I mean, it's very much unlike the Natasha Kampusch case. That's the case of another Austrian woman or girl who was kidnapped at the age of 10 and kept in a cellar for 8 years. She's gone public on the whole thing. She's written a book. She's been interviewed countless times, and there's been a film made about her. Elizabeth Fritzl is the absolute diametric opposite. She's kept absolutely silent.
And even though comparisons are utterly unhelpful in this regard, but is there anything, I mean, in psychiatric terms, in kind of general rule books, for what is the more effective way of dealing with a profound trauma such as the one suffered by both Natasha Kampusch and Elizabeth Fritzl? Is it one to seek privacy and try to rebuild your life within, or to be open and in the way that Natasha Kampusch has been?
Each person has to, you know, choose their own way, and obviously under the guidance of psychiatrists. But I think in the Elizabeth Fritzl case, she obviously does have people who she talks to, and she's close to her own family, and that's being rebuilt. And I think because the children are so young, or were young, I mean, the youngest boy is now probably about 12, that the media is warned off, both by the psychiatrists and everybody else, because you can't do this under Austrian law. You can't march in and start interviewing minors. And that risk would have been there. With Natasha Kampusch, you've got a completely different case. You've got somebody who is basically alone. She has problems with her own family and has said publicly on many occasions that she wants to go public on this. This is a way of sort of getting rid of the feelings that she has. It's a way of coming back into mainstream life by talking about it, by having a film made about her life, by giving interviews, by reliving quite a lot of those experiences. It's not to say, I mean, when one sees Natasha Kampusch, and I've seen her on many interviews, that she doesn't seem to be totally readjusted at all, to be honest. She's in her early 20s, but she doesn't seem like a normal, completely normal woman in her early 20s. She's obviously still traumatized, but I think if you look at how she was earlier when she gave interviews not so long after she came out of captivity, that she has made a certain improvement.
It certainly sounds like maybe the reason she gives all those interviews and she writes books and contributes to films is an inability to let go to what happened to her.
Well, she says, or she has said, that she's forgiven this man Wolfgang Pricklepool. He was an electrician who kidnapped her and kept her in the cellar for 8 years. She said she's forgiven him because this is the only way that she can actually deal with the case. She said that if I kept on hating him and thinking about this whole period, then it would have poisoned me and I wouldn't have been able to live a proper life. So she, whether we believe her or not, or whether that's true, that's what she says. She says she's forgiven him and that's helped her to come through it.
There's something of a cultural stereotype, perhaps, about Austrians or Germanic people from that part of the Alps that, you know, of people who are almost obsessed with their own privacy, which ironically is what abetted Joseph Fritzl for so many years, but perhaps is a huge help to Elizabeth now, Elizabeth Fritzl, who in that, never mind that Austrian law will prohibit any kind of media, unwelcome media intrusion, and she has a police cordon that will protect her as well, but that generally speaking that a lot of Austrians would not want to intrude on someone's life.
I think that's very much the case. I think if you've got somebody who's willing to do so, like Natasha Kampusch, then they're given, you know, all the publicity they want. And Austria's got a very lively tabloid press and takes a great deal of interest in this sort of thing. But if somebody doesn't want to, if they want privacy, then in Austria and in most places, I think, with somebody who's suffered an ordeal like that, the press backs off and respects what they want.
One of the three girls that was kidnapped, or allegedly, by this guy Ariel Castro that was arraigned today in Cleveland, Ohio, Gina De Jesus, her sister pleaded with the press for privacy, that even though there's like a huge scrum outside of all the three girls' houses, that they're pleading desperately to be left alone. I mean, I wonder, and perhaps I'm being unfair to American media, but I wonder that it's a plea in vain, that they mightn't find the kind of privacy that they so desperately need.
Given half the chance, the British media would pounce. I'm pretty sure that, you know, parts of the American media would try and do that as well. I think it's in the nature of, sadly, perhaps in the nature of journalism, that, you know, people will try and get that because there's huge public interest in these kinds of stories.
Although, in fairness, we have the case of J.C. Dugard, of course, who has managed to maintain a fairly low profile since her release. I think it was in 2009. It's the scrum of interest in, and not always prurient, but, you know, it's this almost kind of morbid fascination with an unimaginable ordeal.
Yeah, just an almost unstoppable roller coaster once it starts. The interest there is so massive that people feel driven to get as much as they can. I mean, I'm talking about the Fritzl case, when Elizabeth Fritzl and her three downstairs or underground children were kept in this wing of the psychiatric hospital. I mean, photographers were climbing over the fences and they had to police the whole hospital and everything. It's difficult to say where the sort of the motive for this kind of behavior comes from. I think that it is just, it becomes a huge competition in these press scrums. It's a giant competition to get as close as you can and get that one bit of information which makes you stand out, which makes the story stand out, and make it look better and more interesting.
All right. Listen, Tony Patterson, Berlin correspondent for The Independent, we'll leave it there. Thank you very much for talking to us this evening.
Thank you.
That was a Davenport After Dark podcast, live every Thursday night at 10 p.m. on News Talk 106 to 108 FM.